what software did you use?
You're gonna love this. I used VR.
VR
for the asset creation. And I watched it and I was like, oh cool, I made it to the top 100. I'm glad they liked it. I get off my phone, I'm like, okay, cool, I'm good. And then all of a sudden, like Matt and Dave and a bunch of people, other people like from Camp MoGraph are texting me like, just
dude, you won.
I was like, no, I didn't. I got the top 100. And I popped the stream back on and they're in the middle of talking about me getting fourth place in that competition.
God, that is so insane.
That's awesome.
That was out of 4,000 plus entries. So I was incredibly blown away by that.
Welcome to the XR Motion Podcast. Today, we're thrilled to welcome a true star in the world of 3D animation, David Mellor, known professionally as Mellow MoGraph. He's based in Portland, Oregon, and David's work as a 3D artist and motion designer is nothing short of phenomenal. His approach to animation combines playful, organic designs with groundbreaking modeling techniques, breathing life into every character and scene with his unique and vibrant style. In this episode, we dive into David's extraordinary achievements in massive 3D animation tournaments and even his journey into VR sculpting. He's mastered tools like Adobe Substance 3D Modeler and Substance Painter, pushing the boundaries of what's possible in art and design. His innovative work has even led him to share his expertise at major industry events like Adobe Max and NAB. So get comfortable and let's get ready to explore the amazing creative universe of David Mellor, aka Mellow MoGraph, right here on the XR Motion Podcast.
Over the years, like, how has your approach to motion design been impacted or changed by the tech that you're using? And how has that sort of furthered your art style?
Houdini definitely changed that for me. Or not Houdini. VR changed that for me 100%. Because I didn't do a ton of character-based work before. Except for like a couple of zebra sculpts and things like that. But with VR, and this isn't really like an answer to how it changed my motion design, but just my overall workflow and approach to 3D in general, is that with the VR, I could get really gestural with it. And I would start to think about things as building almost a kit of assets that I could then use to plug into modifiers and generators and effectors and everything like that in Cinema 4D. But C4D has been, as far as like the specific like MoGraph stuff, that's been my bread and butter for the last 10 years. That hasn't changed at all.
When you were doing your 36 days of type, were you were rendering in Houdini?
Yeah, I was using Redshift and Houdini.
Redshift,
yeah. Nice. Yeah. That's awesome. So how do you like the procedurals? So it's interesting. So you were using Houdini a few years ago. You're also using VR a bit now. You said you started in cinema. What had you say for 36 days of type, I'm going to use Houdini? Was it that you just wanted to try it out? Or were you thinking, like, well, I guess, why did you say Houdini is going to be the way I execute this challenge?
So that was right around the time I was getting the most familiar with Houdini. And, you know, shout out to Chris Rutledge. He was a huge part in helping me learn Houdini. And once I got more familiar with the program, it just kind of felt like I was in kind of a lab, just being a scientist and just putting shit together and just seeing what the result was. And once I got that figured out, then I started to think about it as like, okay, I guess the best analogy right now is, you know, with AI, everything is done with prompts, right? So when I was engineering this look for Houdini for my 36 days of type, it was kind of like that. It was like, okay, give me this, but give me this in the style of this. And I would be directing this prompt with the node network that I was setting up and then doing a lot of back and forth testing to make sure that, you know, geometry wasn't flying all over the place or accidentally clipping out or anything like that. So it was just cool to kind of have that instant feedback of try this node, see what it does. And then I wanted to try that for like a whole series, like a whole series of pieces. And that's where 36 Days of Type came in.
Yeah, I love the procedural generating because, not to say it's easy, extremely hard to get into a style and look that you enjoy, at least from my experience. But once you do that, I mean, it is almost, and correct me if I'm wrong, just plugging in different letters. And then it kind of just makes an amazing, unique look with several different assets, which is just...
Amazing.
I mean, imagine doing that non-procedurally in Cinema 4D, right? I mean,
maybe you get away with some like copying and pasting of, you know, certain materials or certain, you know, modifiers or what have you. But, you know, I was actually going to say, it's funny, like we're having this conversation of like, oh yeah, you built this system. I mean, the real question is how long did the node network take to build? Because I feel like sometimes I get node networks going that you're like, maybe I didn't do anything by hand for 36 days, but I have projects that I've gone in over the course of a month and just like kind of slowly whittled away at trying to find that one, you know, that one attribute that I needed or, you know, whatever I'm looking for. But
it took a couple days to engineer that. And that was, I was thinking about that before they made the official announcement, like, okay, here's your day one, here's A. So I was already just kind of playing around with the idea of doing something like this. And I had some other wild ideas too. I almost did a version where it was this 3D interpretation of like old school Windows 95 with the, like the app windows expanding and contracting. So I was trying something with that and I was like, no, that gets a little bit too busy. So I cut that back. So it was that couple days leading up to having a plan in place was more about just playing around and seeing what style I was happy with. And then once I was happy with it, I was like, okay, cool. I've got this. I'm ready to go. And then I'll just render it once a day, A, B, C, D, et cetera.
Wow. That's awesome. And I love the idea of kind of thinking, and you mentioned earlier about, you know, thinking about like being in a lab, right? And getting to a state of play, especially when you've, you know, done any sort of creative work for an extended period of time, or you use the same programs over and over again, or, you know, you have the same workflows for client work, it can feel really difficult to get into sort of that state of play, which is usually where you find, I don't know, a lot of inspiration or new ideas or new concepts. So it's really cool that you're able to sort of finagle, because for a lot of people, Houdini does not, you know, you can get a simulation, but then like the second you try to art direct it, you're like, I don't know where to start. So to really have a wrangle on it, that's really awesome. And definitely speaks to your technical, as well as your sort of creative proficiency. But I do also want to ask on the concept of challenges. So I know you've been involved with a few other, online challenges, and I think these are becoming a little more common. You have like 36 Days of Type. Like right now is actually November, which I've done a little bit in November. I'm not doing it this year just because I'm way too busy, but like love seeing these kind of structured challenges that give artists an opportunity to, if you don't have work outside of what you're working on for your clients, or you just need a little bump to kind of get something personal going. But I have to ask, what is your experience with other online challenges and how has it been beneficial for you as a motion designer?
So I will say last month was Sculptober and I got to like two or three of those before I stopped. so clearly my consistency game is off, but I do like that there are communities out there that are creating these challenges for designers and artists to just kind of think, like kind of take the, I guess the initial thinking like, oh, what am I going to do today? No, so this prompt list is going to tell me what I'm going to do, and I'm going to try to make my interpretation of that.
Hey guys, real quick, just want to let you guys know about some products we are having in our store. So we wanted to advertise to digital artists. We hope these are a great holiday, birthday, any sort of gifts for either yourself or friends, family, coworkers. You name it. Let us know what you guys think about this, because we really think they're awesome. So I'm gonna cut myself off. Back to the episode.
Whenever I see those challenges, I get excited about doing it. And because then it starts getting me to think about, you know, what could I do with this prompt? And then I completely drop the ball 3 days later.
Well, I mean, that's almost the beauty of it, right? Like, so yeah. November, it was interesting. The first year, the first November I was a part of, it was a prompt every day. And then the next year, they actually switched to a prompt every 2 days. And it was specifically because it was like, we did, you know, the organizers were like, we don't want people to feel like this is a, you have to do all 30. And if you don't do all 30, it's, you know, that's not the point of, at least in their perspective, that's not the point of the challenge. The point is, you know, for exactly to your point, to your point, David, like having some of that sort of difficulty of sitting down with a blank slate or the blank page and thinking, what am I going to make? You know, giving sort of a little bit of context to work with and challenge yourself a bit.
Yeah. Mm. I know that Houdini also has a Hulai. That's another one, which I haven't done yet.
I don't know that one.
What is Hulai?
It's like, it's Houdini in July. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Houdini in July.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh.
Hulai.
Okay.
I can't remember if it's thematically prompted or if it's like do something with these specific nodes. I haven't done it yet. I think it'd be fun to try.
Awesome, actually, because I mean that is you don't use certain nodes unless you take on a project or force yourself to be like, I'm gonna learn, you know, this specific set, because it's just such a massive tool set.
Yeah. Mm. One of these days I would like to do another 36 days of type though and combine my VR sculpting as like the base mesh and bring that into Houdini and do some cool shit around that. So
love
hopefully,
that.
Hopefully stay tuned.
Yeah, that's awesome.
What did you, you were involved with some of Clint Knorr's little render projects, correct? His little competitions he's been doing. Not Clint.
Jones. Yeah.
Yeah, Clint Jones. I'm sorry. Sorry.
Yeah. Right, it's like who?
That was an old friend of mine. I just completely had a brain fart. Yeah.
Shout out.
It's
to,
all good.
Out to my old buddy.
Yeah. But Clint Jones. Yeah. So you took part in some of his render projects, right? Can you just, so I feel like that is probably in our industry, the biggest render competition slash, what would you even call it? Not a competition, but just like gathering of artists all working. It is a competition, you know? Yeah. I mean, but so you were involved in that. Can you just tell us about some of the ones you were involved in and how those went for you?
So the first one I did was the Infinite Journeys one.
Yes.
That was right around the time that I found out that Clint was doing these challenges. And I was like, oh, this sounds like a great opportunity to like take, you know, a base animation, a base scene and put my own spin on it. So that one was like, it was like the horizontal, you're looking out the window of a train or whatever vehicle you decide to make. At the time, Clint, I think that was early 2022. Mm-hmm. It was pretty shortly after Clint and I met at Camograph and at Portland.
Oh, wow.
And so him and I were geeking out a bunch about this game for a Switch called Eastward. And if any of you have played it or haven't played it, totally recommend it. It's a great game. But that was all the game centered around, being on this train and going to different locations through the story. So I really liked the style of the game. It was very pixel arty, but I wanted to try to turn that into a 3D type setting. So I made something based off that sort of style, and then added like a little Easter egg of the train from that game passing by on the opposite side. I didn't place in that, but it was still just a fun exercise just to make something in that. And then I don't remember how I decided to, I think it just happened to see it on his YouTube channel the day that he announced it, but it was the Endless Engines one that he did earlier this year.
Yep.
And for that one, I was just like, oh, this is super cool, because not only am I designing like the interior of a vehicle, I'm just designing the whole vehicle itself.
Mm.
And so that was the one that I placed fourth place in. And then a couple of us.
And I just, I might even restate this in the beginning of the question and edit this in later, but for anybody who doesn't know, Clint Jones is running these competitions where anybody can submit. He sends essentially either a very basic 3D scene, right? Or he'll have parameters that everybody has to follow. The prizes are sometimes sponsored by Camp MoGraph, right? Sometimes they've got like huge licenses. You know, I think Rococo did one, right, where you could get a full suit. Just the biggest sponsors in the industry. And it kind of started off to a few hundred people, and it could be any program, to now like thousands of entries and submissions are being set. So
yeah,
when you say you got fourth place, that is just massive. I mean, were you blown away when you heard that? Like, what? I mean,
oh, dude, I was surprised that I even got in the top 100, because I wasn't even at home. I was listening to the stream while I was at, I think I was visiting my parents that day, and I watched it and I was like, oh, cool, I made it to the top 100. I'm glad they liked it. I get off my phone. I'm like, okay, cool, I'm good. And then all of a sudden, like Matt and Dave and a bunch of other people like from Camp MoGraph are texting me like, just dude, you won. I was like, no, I didn't. I got the top 100. And I pop the stream back on, and they're in the middle of talking about me getting fourth place in the in that competition.
God, that is so insane.
That's awesome.
That was out of 4,000 plus entries. So wow. I was incredibly blown away by that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a hard ask. You got about a month, right, is kind of the timeline about. And it's not like, oh, this is just random 4,000 people. I mean,
top tier.
It is top tier. Yeah. I love that they splice all the top 100 clips together, because it is just masterful. The best creative inspiration I think you could ever ask for. For anybody that's not sure of what this is or has never heard of it before, go look it up. I'm not sure if it's on. So Clint, I know he has a channel at Ponisher. We'll put that in the description. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Maybe, or
I don't know if it's all under that channel or not. But if you just type in Clint Jones, Ponisher. Yeah. If you just type in Clint Jones and then 3D challenges, it should come up. Hopefully we'll have that in the description links. But man, top tier talent, just absolutely. And you being the top tier of the top tier, very exciting, very exciting. How long did it take you to make your project, and what software did you use in order to achieve your video?
You're gonna love this. I used VR. For the asset creation. So when he announced that challenge, I was just like, pretty much right away, I knew I wanted to do some sort of anime motorcycle inspired piece. Not necessarily like Akira.
Right.
But I was thinking more like Dragon Ball Akira Toriyama style. So at the time I started rewatching the original Dragon Ball, and I loved all the proportions of the vehicles and the contraptions in the show. So I wanted to do something akin to that. And I was like, oh, well, what better way to do this than building everything in VR? So before jumping into VR, I spent time blocking out, I took the scene, the template scene, threw a bunch of cubes in there for buildings, did a very, very rough version of the motorcycle, did a quick rig of it, just kind of where the back wheel could pivot properly, just to get that motion in there. and figure out what the hell to do with the rest of this. and then over the time, I just kind of slowly built and chipped away on top of that. So I started with making all the buildings. I sketched them out, and then I brought those sketches into VR and built the 3D versions of them. I textured them procedurally with Substance Painter, brought that back, threw it back into Cinema 4D. I built a cloner system so I could have everything loop seamlessly, which was a big thing that they were excited about when they talked about it on the show. And then from there, it was just repositioning buildings, making sure that the composition, the lighting, everything was looking good, and then just further refining. So,
wow.
Even though it was like the full 30 days, I probably actually worked 15 of those days, and the rest was just kind of, thinking about it and sketching is still part of that process. So
sure.
You know, like 20 out of 30 days total working on it, probably on and off, like an hour or so a day, just to not like stress myself out. Just, you know, this is a fun thing. I just approach this as like a fun little project.
Yeah. Now
I know that sounds super humble braggy too, but it's just,
I feel like that's a really important perspective to have with that kind of stuff where, you know, we were talking earlier about like those daily challenges, right? Which is sort of the same, you know, conceptually it's very much the same, but it's the execution of it's very different, right? Making something every day for 30 days as opposed to taking 30 days to create something that's, you know, highly crafted and very detailed and nuanced and all that. But it's super important when you're working on projects like that to, I think, take a second. If you start to feel frustrated, you know, you shouldn't feel like you do when you're doing creative work and you're on a deadline and that takes, I think, in a bit of the magic out of it, you know?
Yeah. The fun thing too was that I actually gave myself a sort of a pre-deadline to the actual deadline of the project. So I was like, okay, I'm going to stop 2-3 days before it's actually done just to make sure that my editing everything together, because I was doing multiple layers to the project, were turning out correct. And what ended up happening is I had those 3 extra days and I was just like, oh, what else could I do to this to make it fun? And so that's when I started playing with like throwing in 2D effects, like stock.
The 2D effects stock were amazing. Animation. It's like my favorite part.
And then mixed media. Yeah. And then doing like halftone shaders on top of the redshift shader to give it sort of that anime cartoony look, but still have a 3D perspective to it.
So yeah. I want to walk this backwards just because I feel like we're going to show the clip of your work here. So working backwards, exported out in Redshift and Cinema 4D.
Yeah.
And then 2D effects, was that kind of done in After Effects?
Partly. Oh, you're talking about like the smoke and stuff like that. Yeah, that was done in After Effects.
Were you adding in that in afterwards, or were you exporting that as an alpha and then bringing that into Cinema?
I brought those in After Effects. So I did like the external compositing node in C4D, brought that file into After Effects, and then I could just freely place those puffs of smoke and dirt and things like that without having to go back and re-render the whole thing. So
wow.
it saves a lot of time there.
Smart. Yeah. Now I want to ask, now going back, so I kind of wanted to jump into this later, but you know what? You keep bringing up VR, so now I just kind of want to ask some of those questions. We're already here. So
we're here.
I so many questions. I just want to ask, so A, what software are you using? Mm-hmm. What headset are you using? Mm-hmm. I guess we'll start with those first two questions.
And then. So I am using primarily Adobe Substance 3D Modeler.
Nice. I wrote down a note saying, ask him about that. So yeah. Very cool.
So Modeler is, I would say it's kind of like the spiritual successor to Adobe Medium. They're trying to bring over a lot of the features. I don't know to what extent, but that seems to be like the goal. But just with like a refreshed UI, UX, plus the ability to model just with your desktop, like do desktop sculpting and then throw your headset on and suddenly you're in your VR mode.
Now that was beta recently. Is that out of beta yet or is that still?
That came out of beta back October of last year.
Okay, so a little bit out of beta. Now, how seamless is that? Because this was the coolest thing to me. A, I believe it has to be desktop connected, linked, so you can't just use it on a standalone headset. B, I mean, the most revolutionary feature, I think, is having it on your head and quickly taking it off and on. And like when you take it off, you can go from sculpting in VR to instantly how they made it appear on your computer. How does that workflow work like that? Or is that over exaggerated?
No, that's exactly how it works.
Wow.
And that's when I first started using the program, that's how I wanted to kind of approach it.
Mm.
But then I just stayed in VR because I like doing that a lot more.
I love it. Yeah. Keep going.
So like when I use the desktop mode, it's mostly for like making little adjustments or moving things around just because that's where you can see kind of the main composition. Cause when you're sculpting in VR, you're kind of all over the place and your perspective is changing all the time. So
your composition is the world. That's your composition. Yes.
Yeah. The world's your composition. Yeah. Put that on a shirt.
Yeah. Well, don't tempt me.
But yeah, so that's been my main tool. Actually I used Medium a while ago. That was my first kind of jump into VR modeling was I was working with Chris on March of the Ding Dings, which is a music video. Yeah. So
love March of the Ding Dings.
Yeah. So he brought me on to help with like a scene or two, and I was just like, well, he's already doing this really fun kind of VR art style. Like that's how the characters are sculpted. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to make some cars that look like that. And that was my first kind of foray into VR modeling. And then I didn't touch it for like a year. And then when I found out about Substance Modeler, I was just like, all right, screw it. Let's just learn a new program. And then that's when I like was like here to stay for VR modeling.
Wow.
And then I've also used Quill a couple times as well.
Yeah.
Quill's fine.
So how is Adobe Substance, you know, they have Painter and Modeler. Is there a workflow between those two programs or are you primarily texturing in Modeler?
I am texturing in Painter or Designer. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool.
So yeah, I'll just export the model, retopologize it, then bring it into Painter or just straight Cinema 4D and put on like some generative textures to color that, or I'll use Houdini.
Wow. Yep. Yeah. I honestly might as well. Right. Yeah. How with the modeling portion, have you ever used sculpting? And I say Blender because I think Blender's way more superior than Cinema 4D. And obviously Houdini, but have you done sculpting in either Blender or ZBrush or Nomad Sculpt? And if so, how does that hold up against Adobe Medium?
I haven't tried modeling or sculpting in Blender at least I've definitely have not tried sculpting in Blender. back in my day, I was on 1.0 Blender.
Blender, OG Blender did not have any good sculptures in Blender. Only got good in like since like 2.8, which was
and they're great. They're great.
Yeah, they are pretty good.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in just what is being packed into Blender. I know this is kind of like a side tangent, but like it's making me want to try out Blender again after all these years. But I've used Nomad Sculpt. I think that's really cool. And fun. And I've used ZBrush plenty of times too. I really like the VR aspect of modeling because I like to actually move around, like using my head as the camera, essentially. I like to be very specific on how I push and pull my meshes. And with Blender or Nomad Sculpt or ZBrush, you're still limited to just kind of like swiping across on your screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like that kind of spatial freedom that you get with VR.
Sure. I love sculpting in VR. It's fast. I feel like even for, you know, you can't get into some of the fine details, or at least I have been able to, like you can with ZBrush on some of the, you know, HD texture geometry, but for getting out just a fantastic high poly, still high poly model, I mean, in VR, it's just so fast. The fact that you can just, as fast as you can move your head left and right is how fast you're moving your camera, which that in itself saves so much time.
I hate panning and rotating around with a camera. I don't want to deal with a camera in my scene.
Right? Again, hate versus fun as shit. You know, like it's like, it's 100%. Kind of a, you know, it's crazy. So what hardware are you using? Because the problem why I stopped is because for anybody that the Quest 1 kind of sucked, in my opinion. I just didn't have, because, and maybe it doesn't for everyone, but I have the Valve Index. So with the Valve Index, just way better in quality, field of view, everything. The issue I always had, though, is that I couldn't get close to my screen because the trackers that were required, I'd be out of the tracking zone when I get up near the wall near my computer and my headset couldn't see the trackers. So I couldn't ever do that workflow, but I just got the Quest 3 recently. And so you're pretty much selling me on trying this out. And I'm very, not to say I'm excited to be done with this episode, but I'm very excited.
It's waiting for me. It's waiting for me right now.
I've been this excited to try software in a minute. You're really amping me up.
Fun. Yeah. I am still on a Rift S. So
Okay.
The last bastion of wired Rifts and the formerly Oculus.
Yep. Wow. Well, that's still, I mean, I feel like once you're wired, it's a different experience, you know, just because of the computing power. It's amazing. You get such a different experience with. So how high res are you feeling you're getting these models? Do you feel like that's it? Or do you still do cleanup and touch up after you're done modeling in VR? Or is it pretty much like export done, you know, we're moving on to painting?
I still do some touching up. Whether it's like taking it into ZBrush and like sculpting in little folds or something, or even just running the Zero Mesher just to get some clean topology that I can then UV and slap some textures on. I still do like a little bit of cleanup.
Nice. Now what kind of, if you could say, what are some of the downfalls that come with VR sculpting?
I guess the biggest thing is that it's probably not for everybody in terms of like motion sickness. Like if that's, there are ways that you can kind of navigate around that. One way that I've talked to people who do get motion sick is they just kind of like sit down or they just limit their use. But that's kind of the thing right now, is that it's, you're really limited to how well you can tolerate motion sickness. When I first started using VR, I was feeling really weird about it. I think the first time I threw on a headset was, it was like E3 or like PAX, and was like trying out a game. And as soon as the character would start moving forward, I felt my stomach just lurching forward. And I was just like, I can't do this. No, fuck this. No VR for me. But then as I found out more about people using it for content creation, I was like, maybe I'll take a look at it again. And so rewind to 2021, the cold winter of February 2021. I was just like, let's go get a headset. Let's go play around with it and play some games on it. And so we did that for a little bit, and then I started playing around with VR modeling then, and I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. And then let that kind of slip to the side, and then it wasn't until last year that I really got into it.
So I'm going to ask, just because we went, I feel like I'm sorry, Andrew, kind of almost went way off script with the, my excitement.
I think we went on a tangent, yeah.
A little bit too much. I'm so amped here. So with the, I know you did, that was the Endless Engine, I believe, was the last one you did? Did you do multiple competitions with Clint, or was that just the one competition that you entered in for?
I did Infinite Journeys, and then I did Endless Engines.
Endless Engines, that's right.
Yeah, I wanted to do the most recent one, the boss fight one, because that looks really fucking cool.
That was so sick.
Yeah, and I was in LA at the time for Seagraph, and I had my laptop with me, so I was just kind of blocking out the scene. And then, you know, my girlfriend and I went traveling and stuff like that. So I was like, nah, I'm not going to, I'll just let this pass this time. So I'll probably come back for the next challenge. The guy who, Fabricio, I don't know if you met him at camp, but he was the one who placed won. First.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he got first in the boss fights one. So yeah. two in a row, first place is insane.
Yeah, I touched it. I was laying on the ground and I touched his robe and I instantly got more creative. It was wild.
It happened to anyone who was graced by his presence.
Yeah, super talented guy right there. I'm excited. Do you know when the next one is?
No.
Okay.
It seems like, let's see. So the Endless Engines one was in February, March-ish, and then the boss fight one was in August, like beginning of August. So that's like a 6 month gap. So maybe it's every 6 months. I'm sure it also depends on what Clint's doing otherwise. Yeah.
I love that. Well, okay. I'm excited. I'm going to keep my ears out. We'll have to make sure to mention this more often whenever he announces the next one, just keep people updated with that, because clearly from your experience and just other people's experience, it really is a fun competition, and sometimes people get nervous about it, but again, it's just, it's all fun and games, and you know they've got a great little community over there. So
if you want to have just a big community to chat with and to bounce ideas off and, you know, take part in competitions that just kind of help you think about your own work differently or in a new way, Clint's Discord and his community is definitely the way to go.
Yeah, it really is. Well, focusing back on you, so clearly you have just a wide range of different programs you're using, and different workflows. But one thing that's interesting is when you check out your work, you always have the same style. I feel like that you have a very clear style, at least on most of your work, where it's fun. It's, you got a great saturation in colors. It's stuff that makes you smile and curious and feel great. What is kind of your process for your inspiration when it comes to your personal projects?
A lot of Pinterest surfing comes up for inspiration. It also just kind of goes back to, my childhood and even just stuff I'm interested in now growing up. Like I said, I was really into claymation. And so I bring a lot of that characteristic into my work, whether it's, you know, big shapes or even using like the grayscale gorilla clay textures to make it feel like it's a stop motion thing. And also just, you know, I watch a lot of cartoons or play video games, and I inject some of that, those things that I like, into my pieces to make it feel more personal. And then from there, it's kind of working with the tools that I'm using to build that visual style, right? So with VR, I'm like doing big strokes, or I'm just like pushing and pulling apart and doing these things that I'm gesturing with my hands right now to make those pieces. And so I'm not too concerned about like the finer details of it, because the style that I'm going for is more of like this large scale handmade look that VR kind of lets you do. I mean, you can get as detailed as you want, but I just like to keep it kind of simple and playful.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like I was thinking about ways to describe your work, or at least how I perceived it. And I feel like one of the things that kept coming up for me was like this idea of it being tactile. And it's, now that we're talking through your inspiration points of like claymation for sure, right? So from a texturing standpoint, kind of having like the stop motion feel to it, again, the size and distribution of shapes. But beyond that, to know that you're using VR so much, I'm curious to know, you know, with that kind of emerging tech and more people doing that kind of modeling, you know, instead of traditional box modeling or, you know, you know, doing subdiv workflows, whatever, getting in and actually making stuff with as close to your hands as you're going to get right now. If that kind of has that impact of kind of, it just feels a little more handcrafted, you know?
That's what I love about using VR is that, and I've told this to a couple people too, is that it feels like you're the closest to making digital content with your hands as possible.
It's the closest feeling you'll ever get to becoming a god, really, just manifesting matter with your own fingers.
Build a whole world.
Yeah, what did you say earlier? The world is your camera.
The world is your canvas.
Canvas, something like that. Yeah, no, it's awesome. Like I loved the wall. Yes, like that was such a great, for me, like took me back, because I think Wallace and Gromit probably was, outside of the realm of traditional cartoons, you know, whether it was Nickelodeon, Cartoon Network, that kind of thing. That was I remember feeling a very specific way when I saw that movie for the first time, you know, and thinking like, what is happening here? What is this world that I'm now, it didn't look like anything at the time. And then obviously that spurred such a great sort of, people have been doing stop motion forever, but I mean, think about all the amazing films that came after Wallace and Gromit that I think Wallace and Gromit probably set the stage for. You know, even looking like, you know, in recent years, things like Isle of Dogs or, you know, and there's all of that stuff, when you look at it, you can't help but harken back to like that spaceship crashing into the moon, you know?
Yeah. A grand day out.
A grand day out. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about just this, how much of this new tech that you're using and how well you're finding it. I'm kind of curious what your perspective is in the next, you know, looking forward to the future a little bit, not just for you personally as an artist, but for the industry as a whole. How do you see some of this emergent tech impacting the way we do work? And what do you think the future of work looks like?
Yeah, so... excuse me. In terms of like VR, there's a lot of tools that are made for like content creation. Like you're building your models and your scenes and everything in there. Aside from like Quill, I haven't really encountered a bunch of or many animation tools in VR, which I would love to see more of. And that's something that myself, Chris, and some other colleagues have talked about wanting to see more of in VR. I mean, these headsets and the controllers, you're basically in a like a faux mocap suit. So like, use that, and you can, you know, Procreate Dreams is coming out later this month, and you know, in that you can move your icons and models in your scene just by sliding your hand on your iPad. So put more of that kind of stuff into a VR app.
Blows my mind. You want to hear the craziest thing ever? Call it a conspiracy theory. And anybody listening, also double check this, because maybe I'm wrong. But so somebody built an entire mocap system based on VR. So tracking the face, the hands, and then your feet. And it was a simple, almost like Mixamo, you just press record program, and then you have full motion and animation for any project you want. Adobe bought out the program and has done nothing and just let it sit in a closet for about five to 6 years.
I don't know if you've seen, how dare you?
How dare you?
I know that Adobe owns Mixamo.
I know.
Well, exactly. Adobe's gonna own anything that.
And guess what they've done with Mixamo in the last 6 years? Jack shit. I'm tired of Adobe.
Yeah, we're saying nothing.
Adobe's antics have got to stop. No, but you know, it's you kind of you see this like some of what EJ did recently with just the single Move AI camera setup. So
AI
came out, right? It's like a three camera, and like, you know, we've had this conversation on the podcast before where like I just keep old tech around. So it's like when I saw the Move AI beta come out and they're like, you can use three, if you have three iPhones that are later than the eighth generation, I'm like, I got like 50 iPhones sitting around. I've got all the iPhones I've ever had. So I'm, you know, that was really exciting. And then I saw EJ do his sort of like a single camera, right? And then there's, so I'm a Blender guy, but like there are Blender plugins where people have built using Python just facial capture that's like with your webcam, you know, and it's definitely not it requires a lot of cleanup, and you know, you still need to go in, you still need you got to have good lighting for it, whatever.
Yeah,
but it's like if we can do that stuff with, I don't want to say rudimentary tech, because that's you know, it's not rudimentary tech. Our phones are wild, but if we can do that with a single phone, right? You would think that like something that with as many sensors and as much, you know, functionality built into it, like a VR headset and set of controllers, like, yeah, why can't we? If you're in, you know, while you're modeling, if you have a rigging sidecar that you can then go to, and then you're in there, and then you're like, let me just record a movement, apply it to my rig, apply that to my model, like that.
And I'm just even thinking too, it's crazy because not only is VR sculpting allow for an advantage with a, you know, free floating camera being your head, but animation, you know, if there's a ball in the air and you just need to quickly move the hand back, reposition the fingers, done. You know, you can just go around the ball, or if you're jumping onto a ledge, you can literally just put the hands on the ledge, you know, or the feet directly just, you don't gotta have four miniature cameras to like.
I think that's probably
from that angle, this angle, like.
Yeah,
I think that's also what's been interesting watching what Unreal's been doing recently, right? Because now there's functionality that game engines traditionally had that that become more appealing if you're, even if you're not a game developer. So even something like Houdini, or really any 3D program now, setting up colliders, right? So like you have some rigid body physics, and then you want to have things collide with them. But like to your point, Michael, like, you know, imagine you're rigging a character and you are in an engine that acknowledges this is a character and this is a table. And if the character comes in contact with that table, you know, their hands interact accordingly. Like that's the kind of stuff where Unreal is kind of got so much of that logic baked in already that like, you know, I don't know if you guys have been following the Avalanche stuff, but I am so pumped. I am so pumped for Avalanche. I think it's going to be a crazy couple years here. And I think it's maybe the first time that we have, like, I don't want to say the Adobe killer yet, but like Adobe's going to have a lot of work to do. If it's, you know, I just watched the keynote today. And it's
real time. It's real time. Real time. Real. What? Like, get out of here, finally.
Plus, what are we doing? Properties, like Essential Graphics just came to After Effects a few years ago, right? Like,
why does two shapes with text on it take 10 minutes to render? What are you doing? Like, why?
What are we rendering on? What is happening here?
What is happening?
Yeah.
So it's interesting because, I mean, you're seeing this I feel like we're starting to see this convergence of like I would say for a few years there, it felt a little uncertain. Like, what are we doing? Are we doing VR? Are we doing AR? Yeah. Are we doing, are we still just going to stick with the way that we've been doing it for forever? And now I feel like we've hit this threshold of like, oh, wait, now I can actually kind of step back and be like, this is all going to intersect at one point, and I think it's going to be pretty awesome. I mean, I think I think the accessibility of tech, David, you mentioned earlier, the motion sickness thing, I think is huge. I think figuring out whatever it is that looks like, you know, my wife, the second she put a headset on, I was like, you're going to love it. It's going to be so cool. I'm so excited to show this to you. And she put it on. She's like, I'm going to throw up everywhere if you don't take this off my head right now. You know, like that sucked. Yeah. It was there was no way to fix it. You know, adjusting the dye after whatever doesn't fix it. So I think maybe if it's like a resolution thing or like a frame rate thing. But I think if we can get through that barrier, and we'll see what like this Apple Vision Pro does, I think that's an interesting push as well. But
that's going to be a really interesting thing too, because the Vision does not have any controllers. So
I know
in terms of in creating that digital content, I'm really curious what developers are going to do to like navigate around that. Like, are they going to start having to figure out how to build tools with your fingers or things like that, or
right,
you know,
it's like it's maybe like two fingers, three Did fingers, you know, yeah. like
yeah, throw the horns to use your grab tool.
If that's you want that item, you just go like this, just shoot the web at it,
yeah, it'll pull it towards you. Yeah,
did you guys see the pin? What's the pin? Why am I blanking on the name of it? It just came out. This AI pin. It's like it's basically like this little wearable that you put on.
Oh, I saw that. Humane. Apple, one of their engineers,
former Apple designer, and it's called the Humane AI Pin, right? And it's like, it's getting run by the internet right now. Everyone's having a field day with it. I think it's an interesting conversation to watch. But, I mean, a lot of it is like, so it's just this little wearable pin that you wear on, you know, it's magnetic, I think. You clip it on your collar or whatever. You can talk, so it's all voice activated, gesture activated, like touching or tapping it, swiping it. And then it has this little display that when you hold your hand out, it displays onto your hand. So it doesn't have a screen, it just has these little LEDs. And to be honest, even the launch video, I'm like, I'm not really sure what it does, other than it's all we know is that it's backed by AI, which could be, I don't know, mean anything. It can play music. You can show it like a handful of nuts, and it'll tell you how much protein is in the handful of nuts that you're, you know.
That's kind of cool.
We're starting to see all of these sort of like, at first it was computers, right? Like keyboard, mouse. And then we started getting trackpads, and then we started getting touch screens, and then we started getting cell phones. And I think now we're just like starting to see more and more of it. It's sort of stagnated for a while, but whether it's like VR or even to a certain extent AR or something like this wearable pin, which, act as a, to be honest, I'm ready to not use a mouse all day. My hands, like I try to take care of my hands, and my hands still hurt after.
I don't use a mouse, period. I just use a graphics tablet. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I switch between the two, and I've got keyboards, and I've got like four ergonomic mice. I've got a Wacom, you know, all these things to mitigate the toll that using some of these devices takes on your body. I think that's one of the things that I think for me is so appealing about, you know, AR or VR is that, like get me moving, man. Like get me touching stuff and moving and feeling and, you know.
What if I told you that this was the only tool you needed? I completely agree. It is fun to see, you know, how many new tools are coming out. And I want to ask David, speaking of kind of this new tool, have you experimented at all with AR? What's kind of your thoughts there?
I haven't played with AR yet. So I don't really have an opinion on that currently.
Fair enough.
But like the stuff I've seen it being used, like filters and stuff, or even just augmenting 3D into a physical space, I think that's really cool. I just did a short film for, have you guys heard of Hellavision?
That sounds super familiar, to be honest.
So they just did their latest compilation episode. And for that, I wanted to do 3D characters in like real time film space. But all of that was still done like in post, like shoot my film, bring it into C4D to motion track it, and then comp it all in After Effects. But I that kind of stuff is really cool to me, like to be able to create your content and have it just physically in real life. that you could maybe, you know, make a short film with, like just have an app where it has your animation going, but then you can set it down anywhere and just make a film.
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, it's very, I could see that happening. I feel like Apple Vision Pro is going to be the main thing that kind of starts to spark that. Like the Quest 3 it really made me feel like people just overhype things for views. You know what I mean? But people are like, you can read text on your phone in the Quest 3. Yeah, really, you can't. I mean, if you are squinting and stay very perfectly still and get the right angle, you can read it. But I would not suggest that. But, you know, with Apple Vision Pro, they say you can. And, you know, so it'll be, I'm excited because I feel like a lot of people are going to start developing cool 3D experiences for it. So I don't know. Well, we'll see.
I'm just saying, but I can read text on my phone without a headset on.
A solution in search of a problem.
Yeah. With the Quest 3, I just wanted to, I guess, kind of wrap it all around to is like with the touch gestures, this sounds stupid, but the Quest 3, I started using just my hands a lot more and it's actually pretty nice. Like I kind of like just, I thought the pinching was so stupid when I first saw it, but it feels good. Like it works, you know, like you'll be looking at something and you just kind of like pinch and it just rolls down or you click it and it clicks buttons. And even for typing numbers and stuff, it almost feels like quicker if you, or on the keypad, you know, you're just kind of like doing that really quick instead of using your thumbs and then awkwardly holding your controllers at an angle.
Oh, yeah.
It's just,
you got to do the chef kiss hands whenever you want to sculpt. I did see a commercial for the newest Apple Watch where I guess you can just like pinch your fingers and that's how you can answer a call or check your calendar. That's pretty cool. So I guess, you know, we had this before. This was the previous touch gesture. Now it's going to be just this
for future apps. Pinch to zoom, tap. Yeah. Like that's crazy. Yeah. Wait, so it must be something in like the muscles of your arm that it can like,
that's what I'm wondering if it's like, cause it has the IR sensor on the back of the watch. Really? So I'm wondering if it's like picking up on the muscle contractions and is able to pinpoint. Yeah, like even just doing this.
I mean, if you look at your arm, you do that.
I was just testing it and it just went on.
Made you look.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Oh, is that a new one?
Yeah, it's. I don't know. I haven't tried the double touch yet. It just went.
Learn something new every day. Seriously, that's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. Yeah, look at that. It pulls up the menu and stuff. That's crazy.
Damn.
Nice.
Sorry. I do have a hot take question for you. We're trying to put things that are like maybe a little it might get dated quickly, but it is topical. So the DreamWorks co-founder Jeff Katzenberg recently said that he thinks AI could cut 90% of animation labor and jobs. And more broadly, Elon Musk thinks that there will, quote, come a point where no job is needed. I'm curious if you agree and what your thoughts are specific to the animation industry.
I think that's bullshit. I think that... I think that AI is going to help augment people's jobs, but I still think it's a ways away from replacing, especially animation jobs or creative jobs, because there's that joke where it's like AI isn't going to replace, you know, creative directors because creative directors don't know what they want until they see it. And so I think it's going to be a lot of like that in just, you know, the broader creative industry. And I think that we're going to reach a point with AI that people are just going to get tired with it and they're going to want that personal touch. That it's going to have like that renaissance period, you know. That even things like stop motion animation, like Leica Studios, all their stuff is like done by hand with a little bit of CG, but just having, you know, that that human touch is really important for creativity. And I think that that's not going to be ever completely replaced.
Yeah, I think it's what I feel like we're seeing is that the people who hold the money will probably be like, yeah, let's get rid of as many people as we can.
I
think very quickly people are going to be like, yeah, but now all your content sucks. Like,
you exactly. Know, like, it's going to backfire.
Right. I think we might go through an era of that because, yeah, I mean, if the bottom line sort of dictates anything, it's going to be that. But I think that especially I just saw some former DeepMind Google developers, and I don't think it's a peer reviewed study yet, but they, and this is an older GPT model, but they've done this really, really extensive research that basically points to these models are not good at generating things that are outside of the data that they've been trained on. So essentially, like, it's still really bad at coming up with genuinely novel ideas, right? It's right now it's still sort of hobnobbing a bunch of stuff together.
Everyone else's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying too, is the parameters are, it's when you let it off a leash, it can make things that are not appealing. Like, sorry, let me rewind, but when I was mentioning DALL-E 3 the other, or DALL-E 2, well, now we're on DALL-E 3, but DALL-E 3 versus Midjourney. Like, Midjourney cannot make a face with three eyeballs. It literally cannot. So in order for people to make a beautiful object, or for Midjourney to make a beautiful object, it has to kind of go under parameters on what it thinks something beautiful is, which is symmetry of two eyes, one nose, one mouth. And it's very difficult for it to break because it wants to continuously produce great looking images. So it's like, in order for people to use these massively broad AI models, it has to work for everybody. So in those own cases, everybody's going to keep kind of getting the same results. So in order to like tune it into a different direction, it has to be trained on completely different, I don't know, which is going to, I'm going on a tangent there, but.
The core concept being that, like, we're going to always need people making things from imagination.
Yeah.
You know what? It, funny enough, you know what AI can't do still? It can't render a backwards hat. It just cannot.
Oh, really? I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend a couple weeks ago because he was playing around with it, and he said that every time he puts in backwards hat, it always just makes the hat some weird shape, but then the bill is always in the front. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah. So try that out.
Like a specific, any specific app he was using or model he was using?
I think he was using Midjourney.
Mm. Okay. That's what I'm saying. Midjourney is very, like, the better people go, oh, the image results are even better now. Like, you always get a good image. I'm like, yeah, but you can't, like, go stray away from this certain look that they've developed. It's always the same look and style. And they've nailed it down to, like, 99% of what you create is going to be absolutely stunning and beautiful, but it's, you can't get out of those boundaries. It's pretty interesting.
I preferred the first model of Midjourney just because it was way more abstract and actually let you kind of interpret yourself what these shapes and forms and compositions and colors could become. Whereas now it's like, you know, aside from a backwards hat, everything is really on the nose and kind of feels unoriginal.
Mm.
I don't know.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you said with the human touch. I really feel like that's so undervalued when it comes to what, like, when people are saying, oh, I enjoy art, I want, you know, to see a great movie. I 100% think that the human touch is super important. I feel like that's why when they make an Indiana Jones movie, they have to have Harrison Ford, you know, like, you're going to watch it because Harrison Ford is in it, not just a random thing. You know, it's like those actors you're going to see, the director that made that movie. It's like they become a part of your lives, and you want
even the whole thing with Mario, where they had Chris Pratt as Mario in the movie, and then there's the newer, like, Charles Martinet stepped down, and now there's a new actor. So yeah, people just have, it's how you emotionally connect to other people, right?
Right.
You're giving the Harrison Ford analogy. It's like people want to watch it because they have an emotional attachment to him as an actor and for this particular character. And they can't imagine anyone else being Indiana Jones.
Yeah. I mean, and it's crazy. And I just think that's so over or underlooked is like how much we love that human touch in art. Yeah. I mean, it's what makes you love it, you know, and it's, that was
and the backlash that we've gotten so far, I think have been around like, the like anti-aging that we've done. I feel like even that was divisive for people, you know, like, what was the mob movie, The Irishman, right? That was one that people were like, what the hell did you all do? Like, you know, I mean, it was a creative decision. And, you know, I guess, I don't know, they thought the tech existed. Or, you know, in the Star Wars movies, like, let's just fully CGI render in some people that are no longer with us. Like, people, you know, I think I remember people just having sort of this reaction of like, this was weird, you know, like, it was uncanny. It's like uncanny. Yeah. It's a new uncanny valley almost. So,
but well, I will say in one sense, though, it is getting better and better and better. Some of these looks and feels with these deep fakes. But the funny thing is that their whole thing is to recreate the human, you know, versus another character. It's still going back to that essence. Like in the new Indiana Jones movie, they kind of finally nailed deepfakes. I mean, it was spot on compared to The Irishman, you know, and then you go into Star Wars, like Luke, that was super shocking when they brought in Luke. Then they just had Hayden Christensen as, you know, him doing his Anakin thing. They didn't de-age him to a kid, but just kind of down 10 years, shockingly good. I was blown away how good that looked. And then with the Indiana Jones thing, you know, going into this movie quality, it was pretty good. But the thing is that the de-aging and all of the AI deepfakes were to make them look more like themselves or more like we thought they looked like.
Yeah. You know?
It was to make them look more human and this idea of who we remembered. So,
Just smooth out the face a bit, you know, make them younger. Yeah.
Give me that Instagram filter, but like may it look legit.
Go ahead.
Well, I was kind of, well, it's the same subject. I just wanted to say that the one thing, I don't know if you experience, this is my last thing on AI, but have you seen the AI to 3D models yet?
I saw the one that you made the other day of the Pikachu.
Amazing.
But I haven't seen much more than that. Aside from one like Twitter post where someone made a couch in using the 3D to AI,
but then all the comments, 50,000 polygons.
Yeah. And all the comments were like, you could have done this with like 20 or 30 polygons.
I used the text to 3D way, way, way back. Like, I mean, I say way back, it was probably like 6 months, but that feels like a lifetime. And all it could do was couches. And I don't know what it is about the couch being the, like the reference point for these texted, but I also did hear that, some of the, I think it might've been the one that you used, Michael, was, I think it's like no matter what, it spits out 50,000 polygons. It's like a fixed amount. That's just what they do. 50,000
I'm so shocked that, you know, I'm curious as how they do their texturing on there because it's actually pretty damn good. Like the Pikachu, it's really the base model is pretty shit. And then the texturing is really what sells it as the item or object it is. And that to me is mind blowing that they're doing these UV maps so perfectly. But yeah, when you look at the actual type, you know, and the polygons, it's so bad. And I wonder why they haven't done or developed a process like a retypo, like run it through a Z remesher first or any of these Dynatype, you know, Nomad Sculpt, Dude, like Houdini, or something.
A quick plug, Houdini 20's new quad remesher.
It takes seconds. It's so right. It's and so if fast. They just did that and mm-hmm. then added on the material on top of it, that would be now you'd be dealing with some pretty damn good models, and you feel like the points would be you could I don't know. I don't I honestly have no idea how it's even made. To me, it's fucking magic, but
I wonder if the mesh density is because it's doing like some sort of like vertex coloring and then turning that into a texture, but not really reducing the polygon count after that. It could be something like that.
So it's using the visuals to
I thought it was like kind of like, so right now I've been doing this it's actually it's been huge for a couple things. So you know, backgrounds of renders, you know, it can be easy to like throw some props and stuff in your foreground, and but like to really start building out whatever's going off, way, you know, even if it's like out of focus, you got to fill the space, right? So just prompting for a scene, or, you know, whatever you're working on, prompt I needed, so the thing I just did today, I needed like a mountain range on the water under the Milky Way with like a few moons, so I prompted that Mid Journey, brought into Photoshop, did the neural filter for depth to 3D, you know, it's basically their it's like their refocused neural filter, but you can output a depth map, so then you just bring that image in as a plane. Then you displace it using the depth map you got from Photoshop, and it's not real geometry, but it's like pretty convincing geometry if it's far enough away from the camera. Actually responds to lighting, actually responds to, you know, volumetrics or whatever. And so it's like when I thought of, when, as soon as you said the text to 3D thing, it's like, yeah, it would almost make sense that it could work as like, it's not really text to 3D, it's text to image, right? And then the image gets depth mapped with another AI, and then the depth map gets used to produce, like, I don't know, we now we've got like all this Gaussian splatting or whatever they're calling it.
Gotta get into that too.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think you could actually start with an image, which is maybe the most, like to your point, the most convincing part being like when you prompted for Pikachu, you actually got like the yellow body and the little red cheeks and the, you know, the spot, the brown spot on the back, like and then just starting there rather than starting with what you think is just like the 3D model, you know.
Enough, the somebody commented on the video I posted and they said even the AI thinks Pikachu's tail is black. Even AI is in an alternate dimension. I was like, oh my gosh, the Mandela effect.
Yeah, Mandela AI.
It's proven that we're in another dimension. Yeah, I thought that was so funny. It's, I'm excited about the future. Speaking of the future, what's in store for you? Like, where do you see yourself? And maybe, I know that's like a big question considering we're speaking about all these hypotheticals and crazy scenarios, but in like 5 years or 3 years, where do you see yourself, or what's a dream project that you would just love to work on?
A dream project. I've actually been thinking about this more recently. I think what could be so fucking fun is to just go traveling for like have some sort of mobile setup and just travel and shoot footage and then like composite little 3D characters and stuff like that into each of those scenes that match thematically with wherever I'm at, and then just produce like short film episodes around like my travels and this more specifically this character's travels. So that it's is
like
something
flat,
that
it's like flat Stanley, but like in 3D. I don't know if you
yeah, 3D remember. Stanley.
Like had to do flats. I had to do that as a project in elementary school, where you basically just passed this thing around and people took pictures with it all over the world, and you got it back in the mail.
After
And you're like, wow, this little character went all these places in the mail. That's awesome. That's a really cool concept. I love that. Yeah. And also, it sounds like, do you like to travel? I mean, that's a perfect, it's a win-win.
I would love to travel more. But yeah, I do like traveling. I like to go
places. It's tough when you're trying to render out these like epic, you know, can be, I feel like as after a little bit of time traveling, I'm like, I got to get back to my rig. I'm like really missing some of the juice.
Just got to have the big rig at home that you can just remote into to actually render your frames, but then have the, you know, I've got a MacBook Pro and an iPad that I can just sculpt my characters on and then bring them into C40 on my laptop and then just network render from across the world, ideally.
Hell yeah. Well, if you're ever in New York, you got to bring said character out to an XR meetup, because I feel like we could do some very cool little shorts like that. And honestly, that was actually, I feel like that integration of 3D, and I mean, it already shows in some of your work. Like we were talking earlier about the 2D, you know, the 2D composites on top of the doing standard render, halftone shader stuff on top of a redshift shader. That is like, you're really, really strong at developing a visual style, you know, incorporating those different elements. I feel like I'd be very excited to see what you put together, you know, using real live action footage as well.
Yeah, and lately I've been trying to do more sort of stylized, non-physically based rendering too, like playing a lot more with the tune shading happening in C40. I know Blender has a good tune shader as well, but for the moment just trying that stuff out and seeing how far I can push that in Cinema.
What are they called, OSL shaders? Is that the other one? Is that like the
I haven't
touched them. I've just seen what people do with them, and I'm like, I have no idea what this is, but it looks wild.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like that's, I think I've asked all of my questions. Andrew, did you have more questions?
No, I was actually going to say, I feel like we're coming up on an hour and a half, and I know we've definitely been trying to keep it a little tighter, just because we want it to edit down to like an hour and a half. So I feel pretty good. I was going to say, David, if there was anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't ask, or any projects that you wanted to kind of call out, otherwise, I think we can kind of do like a, you know, for anyone who wants to keep up with you and your work, where can they find you online?
Pretty much all my social media is on Mellomograph, M-E-L-L-O, Mograph. Twitter, Instagram, SoundCloud, if you want to listen to some music that I'm working on.
Hey, definitely.
And then my website.